Welcome back to the Mining Pod. On today's show, we're joined by Isaac Fithian and Reap Browning of Cathedra Bitcoin to talk about underclocking Bitmain ASICs. We talk about underclocking versus overclocking, how voltage and frequency play into the terahash output of machine, and implications for bear market mining.
Introducing the newest and most requested course from Foundry Academy, Intro to Hashboard Diagnosis and Repair, offered by the same experts who provided top technical training for mining technicians in the U.S. This Essential Academy course will take place in Rochester, New York from May 1st to the 5th, 2023. With a strong focus on mastering microsoldering basics, Foundry's dedicated instructors possess years of ASIC hardware experience and will guide you through each step of the process. They'll ensure that you gain the confidence and skills required to undertake basic repair jobs and keep your operation healthy and hashing. Register today at foundryacademy.com.
Welcome back to the Mining Pod. I got two world-class builders with us today. It's going to be a treat episode. You might have recently seen them on Marty Bent's podcast, but we got them here on the Mining Pod to go more in-depth and talk about a recent report they put out about how you can underclock machines and be really specific with the temperature that you're putting into a machine in order to get more Bitcoin hash rate out of it, or at least make it more efficient. So Reap Browning, Isaac Fithian, welcome to the show. Thank you guys both so much for joining today.
Thanks for having us.
Cool. So, Isaac, I think I'll toss it to you first. Just lay the land for this whole conversation, the context for what we're talking about today.
Sure. So, Cathedra had several pre-orders of the S19J Pro series miners, and we were looking for homes for them. Now, this is amid the context of, you know, Bitcoin's crashing a bit. You know, hash prices are deflated. And, you know, we're sort of looking for homes for these pre-orders that we've got coming in. And so it's like, okay, you know, we can, you know, put out a good chunk of change, you know, down deposit, put in a hosting facility. We can, you know, go through the capital outlay of setting up a site from scratch. But, you know, really, what's the most capital efficient way of deploying these pre-ordered miners? And so we kind of looked at the full suite of infrastructure that we had access to at Cathedra and said, hey, what's the best way that we can get these deployed, you know, being capital efficient, which, you know, is near and dear to every big miner's heart. You know, you're always trying to find how you can do more with less, right? So we looked and, you know, one of the sort of problems we had was we had a site, the legacy site originally built for, you know, the S9 series miners. So it's designed for miners that are much less power dense, right? So you've got lots of receptacles, lots of PDUs, lots of rack space, right? But, you know, not necessarily high current carrying capacity on a, you know, a per circuit basis. So it's like, well, what do you do with that? How do you get that to run? So, you know, originally REIT had gone out there and was getting the first sort of tranche of pre-orders plugged in, and the PDUs were capped. And so it's like, okay, well, if this miner is running stock 3000 watts, I can only put one S19 per PDU on a continuous basis, which is, you know, in terms of fully utilizing your infrastructure, pretty wasteful, right? So then we sort of got clever and said, well, hey, as long as the phases all match, we can have 1.5 miners per PDU. So we would put, you know, a one miner, one PDU, and then, you know, the S19J Pro series has two C13 plugs on it. And so we would split that over two PDUs of similar phase. So it's okay, you know, 50% improvement on our utilization of infrastructure. It sure beats, you know, having an S19J Pro and an older model like an S9 or, you know, what's miner, M20S or something like that, right? Just to fill in the holes. So then we have these pre-orders coming in, and it's like, okay, what if we could just underclock these a little bit, just enough to get it so that two of them together is right below that threshold of 5,760 watts. Can we do that? Is that feasible? And we tinkered around with firmware. It's like, hey, we can do that. Now we've got two miners of PDU, a little bit less hash rate. Right. But, you know, we're utilizing our infrastructure and we noticed that, hey, the efficiency improved on these things. You know, Brains had put out an excellent study on the effects of temperature on efficiency. and specifically with the, you know, the S19 models, and like they're very susceptible, which makes intuitive sense, right? They're a smaller chip. You're starting to get into issues with quantum tunneling at the chip level. You know, you're much more susceptible to heat, right? So it makes sense. When people think about changing clocks, they automatically, oh, we're going to overclock. You know, we want to squeeze more hash rate out. But there's another side to that, which is beneficial in bear markets, and that is underclocking. Because the ultimate goal is if you increase cooling, you can increase the net efficiency because the chip at the chip level, it's more stable. You can do that by, you know, immersion cooling, you know, water blocks, feeding it liquid nitrogen, but you can also do it by reducing the power that you put through each chip. And if you reduce the power going through it, you're reducing the heat density because you've reduced the power density, and that can also make the chip more efficient. So there are efficiency gains to be had by running less power through the chips, you know, within certain bounds, right? Depending on what the chip architecture, all kinds of stuff. So we're just like, hey, let's look. Let's see what we can get out of these things. And it's like, maybe we can get a third, you know, maybe. And then it's like, oh, we're going to try and put four. Let's see how far we can push this. And, you know, a couple of people on our team were like, Isaac, are you nuts? You know, they...
Me included.
So they're like, you know, you know, first we were having trouble getting more than one a PDU and you want to put four. And, you know, we took a good look at it. And, you know, just given today's conditions of, you know, depressed hash price, you know, difficulty acquiring, you know, infrastructure without, you know, heavy capital outlay and lots of pre-orders, you know, in that context, it made sense to say, hey, you know, it's more efficient to underclock these machines. So that improves margins on a, you know, the amount of revenue you've got coming in for on a per kilowatt hour basis, better margins. It also allows us to get homes for all these miners. So we're, you know, we're making margin on more machines. And, you know, they, you know, it's utilizing our infrastructure in a way that we couldn't have before. So it the stars sort of aligned with our analysis of that given infrastructure. So that's sort of the broad perspective. We can go into, you know, different attributes of that, about why we made those key decisions, but it just seemed to all work together, you know, for our context over at Cathedra.
Love that. Yeah. Thanks for that background, the context there. We'll dig more into the implications in a little bit, which is definitely interesting. I love the call out there. You said like most people think of clocking and they think of overclocking and not underclocking here. And definitely important to think that there's two sides to this. I'm going to throw it up to you, Reid. Talk about the assumptions and the problems that you guys are sort of facing here on a more granular level. We had a nice overview there, the context there, but on a more granular level, what you guys were thinking about, and then how you guys sort of set up the testing scenario here. And for those who are listening, below, we've included a tweet that you can follow along with this, which shows some awesome charts and images that Reid and Isaac have put together for this report.
You know, so we started out with a S19J Pro. I had a 96T, the stuff. Isaac had the 100T model. We were both kind of testing things out independently. The main consideration in this was we first got some numbers. We wanted to see how low we could get our power. And, you know, Isaac said, well, I can get four. It's like, well, I think we can get three. Let's not get over ambitious here. And so, you know, he went and did his thing. I went to and did my thing. And then we started comparing numbers. And I was like, okay, the numbers are very, very similar. The difference between a 96T and a 100T at 3,000 watts, okay, that's, you know, four terahashes, but at lower watts, that margin gets a lot narrower. There are some differences, but it gets a lot narrower. In the winter, when we've been testing, you know, we have access to cold air. So actually creating a control environment is a whole lot easier. The chip temperature noted on these aftermarket firmwares are all wrong, period. The S19 board has four temperature sensors, two on the front, two on the back, and, you know, on each board. We kind of use the intake temperature and the exhaust temperature and looked at that, the chip temperature is always kind of like a 15 degrees Celsius delta on that. So we said, okay,
it's an extrapolation.
It's extrapolation, exactly. So we took that and we said, okay, well, where, you know, where do we start seeing, you know, the benefits? And roughly between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius was kind of where we were landing. We had, you know, 30 degree air available to us. So it was like, okay, well, you know, the fans are kind of doing this thing. But then we started controlling the fans. So, you know, we're noticing that, hey, higher temperature is less efficient. How about if we control the chip temperature and make that a static point? And so, you know, Isaac started finding pockets of where the most efficient points, or where it made the most sense for a four minor setup. I said, okay, well, that's great, but I don't understand what the other possibilities are. And so that's where I started going systematically, you know, volt frequency, volt frequency, volt frequency, and systematically going through each combination possible and looking at the efficiencies at each point, the watt draws, and the terahashes produced at each one of those levels.
Oh, just to interject quickly, just to kind of get a sense of how Reet and I work together, I'm probably a bit more of the cowboy between the two of us. So I'm sort of the one throwing stuff at the wall to see if it sticks. And then Reet's there, be like, well, but does that violate the laws of physics? And so he reels me back into earth a little bit. So, you know, basically I was like, okay, trying to fit four, take the 5,760, we're going to divide it by four. And then, okay, that's my power limit. So what can I get out of a miner, you know, so you sort of have to pick your North Star with these things. You say, well, what are you trying to do? Because everyone always says, oh, well, I just want better. Well, what does that mean? You know, if you're just constantly in the search for better, you know, it's sort of like this void of possibilities, right? It's hard to create a structure of information that guides you, right? So you have to kind of pick, well, what are my objectives here? And we had a clear objective of if we can fit four miners of PDU, that would be very helpful. Basically, I popped the bubble and said, hey, look, you know, this is possible. And then Reet said, okay, now that we know that's possible, let's explore the territory and see if we're missing an optimization somewhere. So, okay, sorry, Reet. Go ahead.
So each one of those points at least was half an hour to 2 hours each. I had to make sure that each point had the same temperature, chip temperature, each time. So if it was too hot, then had, you know, adjust the fans a little bit. Too cold, then adjust the fans a little bit, just so that you have a levelized, you know, you're comparing apples to apples. Each point, there were 218 points, 2 hours each, you know, do the math.
Yes. A lot of hours. Let's take a step back for a second for those who are listening and probably don't know the relationship between frequency and voltage and hash rate and all that stuff. And Isaac, I'll throw it back to you. Can you just give us like a quick 101 coursework on how all those three work together here before we dive back into the temperature side of things and your guys' findings?
Sure. So there's lots of different sort of, you know, models you can imagine when you're looking at, you know, how these electrical systems work, because that's what they are. They're these tiny electrical systems, very, very tiny wires in a, you know, a silicon substrate, right? So you just have to think about it in first principles. Like, okay, I want better efficiency. You know, what does that mean? It means that a job can be performed using less energy, on a per hash basis, right? Using less energy. And it's sort of, yeah. So first principles, what's going on? I imagine these chips as sort of like a little city, and you can change two things. You can change voltage and frequency and sort of influence temperature, right? But the frequency, I imagine it to be kind of like stoplights. So those are logic gates opening and closing. You get to decide how fast the lights change. And you can also decide the voltage. I compare that to sort of the motor you put inside these little cars, right? It determines how much giddy up they've got. So you're sort of looking down on this little city, and you can't necessarily get a report from the electron, right? But what you get to see is, okay, well, how many goods were delivered and for what cost? And that's what you get out of it. You get, you know, what were the input costs and what did I get out of this system? And so you can sort of think of as your hash rate declining when you change a frequency, sort of like a crash report, like, yep, less goods are getting delivered. This isn't working. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I need to create a very stable situation where, you know, when the traffic light goes green, the trucks can get through. And, you know, and when it, you know, when they stop, you know, it stops and it's not, you know, there's not a bunch of crashes. So, you know, like, so from a electron's perspective, what is heat? And, you know, heat at the quantum level, it's vibrations. You know, heat is the vibration of atoms, right? From an electron's perspective, you know, if you're driving down the road and the road starts shaking, you know, you need a lot more energy to course correct and get to where you need to go. So as the chips get hotter, those tiny little roads, you know, the smaller you make that road, the more you feel those shakes, right? Because it's a lot harder to stay on that, you know, it's like going on a balance beam versus an 8-lane highway, right? It's getting super tiny, it's super hard to stay on course. And if the electron doesn't stay on course, then it's not going to produce work for you. And we're down at a scale now where electrons can quantum tunnel through logic gates. So if you're shaking rapidly, you know, you not only are you using more energy for those electrons to get through, but sometimes, you know, you have like invalid shares. You know, like the work's not getting done properly because electrons are going where they're not supposed to when they're not supposed to, right? So, you know, from the electron's perspective, if you can keep those chips cool, then the roads are more stable. They're using less power to do their work. But you also have to balance, you know, okay, you know, if I put the voltage up crazy high, it's like putting a V12 in a little Kia, you know, that's probably going to cause some accident. It's not going to work well because, you know, the lights go green and they're off to the race and it stops, you know, hard to stop. So it's sort of like it's this thing where if you're figuring it out for the first time, you have to intuit what's happening, right? Am I getting a low efficiency because, you know, the engines are going too fast and they're crashing the cars, or are the lights just not going at the right frequency, you know, and you can go back and forth with it. So yeah, like to figure it out, to crack the nut on it first, you sort of have to go from this first principles, like what's happening down there, you know, try and imagine it from the perspective of the electron.
So I love that analogy.
Not to be a stick in the mud, that does break down at a certain, well, once you get into some of the details, but from a general principle, it does work. And mind you, they're independent as well too. So what I mean by that is that, yes, they do have a relationship, but the frequency is just a stat, is saying I'm going to turn on and off at this rate, right? I'm going to open up or turn my light signals on and off at this frequency. So the voltage is more like, all right, how much push should I give to make sure that I get through there with the least amount of resistance? And, you know, that's kind of more like a timing thing.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, sure, raise the voltage. Now you're making sure you get through the traffic light in time, but, you know, how heavy were you stepping on the gas pedal? And so if you're blowing through a bunch of fuel to be able to make it, maybe that's not the most efficient, right? So you sort of need to balance the timing. You know, it's like a well-tuned symphony. You know, everything needs to be in harmony. You know, the electrons go when they're supposed to, the gates close when they're supposed to, the electrons respect that as a barrier, you know, and it's all in a nice natural flow.
I love the back and forth here and just like the dialogue on this, because it's definitely great information. Reed, I want to throw a question back up to you, and correct me as this question might be incorrect, but from my understanding and the tweet thread, again, that I'm going to mention, you guys have these images of, I believe, the different chips, and you take some measurements within the chips. Walk me through that, and walk me through that in relationship to what Isaac was just explaining here. The key mention on the tweets that we saw is the temperature, right? You want to control the temperature, and by doing so, you understand like where the hash rate efficiency is going.
what it is like a 3D map. It's just projected on a 2D surface. And by keeping the temperature constant, right? So if the chip temperature is at 45, and I note this in the tweet where it's plus or minus 2 degrees, 2.5 degrees. But if I keep that static, then the every combination of volts and frequency will produce a certain efficiency, because I'll have a terahash and I have the power draw. So what Isaac is describing is there is at each frequency, there is a nominal hash rate, or a hash rate that is expected to be had at that frequency. If I change the voltage and I go from bottom, like low to higher, the band, or the most efficient band that we found, was when you got to about the 99% of that nominal hash rate, right? Or expected hash rate. Anything above that is that, yes, you can push. Yes, you will get a marginally higher hash rate, but it's not going to, it drops off, right? Like you're essentially just jamming more cars through a light that not necessarily carrying any more valuable information or goods in Isaac's analogy. You might get 1 or 2 terahash more. Is it worth it for the power that you're expending? Not really.
Gotcha. Just to kind of surmise that, it's like, okay, if a traffic light is green for a minute, how many cars could we expect to traverse through this intersection in that duration? And then it stops, and then it goes, and then it stops. So you can sort of calculate, hey, I can expect, you know, X amount of work to happen at this frequency, because, you know, I would assume this much traffic is occurring. So that's the nominal or the expected hash rate. I'm expecting this amount of work to get done if everything goes perfectly. But as anyone who's been on a road knows, things don't always go perfectly. And so, you know, the voltage is, you know, if everyone is sort of on like, you know, Fred Flintstone, you know, pedal cars, they're not necessarily going to make the stoplight, right? And so and then you get problems. Work's not getting done, you know, because there's interdependency on these chips as well. So if one of them is having a hard time, the other ones will as well. So there's sort of this interdependency. Everything needs to be in harmony to produce the best work. And so what Reet's saying is, when we adjusted the voltage so that it allowed each of the electrons to make it to the expected, you know, approximately the expected rate of what the traffic lights were doing, that's where we would find the best efficiencies, which makes sense intuitively, because everything's in harmony.
And to that end, the underside, so like if you look at those charts, there's on the bottom right hand corner this bright yellow thing. What that was is that the power draw in that area is fairly consistent, right? Like, so if I change the voltage, the power draw at the wall is, you know, kind of at this diagonal band, fairly consistent. What is not consistent is the hash rate. So when you look at that area, the hash rate will ramp up, and it will just start nosediving after, because there's not enough juice or not enough to maintain, or not enough voltage to maintain the hash rate.
You know, efficiency can get worse one of two ways. Either you're using more and more power and the hash rate isn't going up accordingly, or your power usage is remaining flat, but the relative work being done for the hash rate is going down. So, the limits of those charts sort of, you know, flesh that out.
Yeah, no, these charts are great. Really show everything in detail. And you just brought me into a great segue there, Isaac. Let's talk about some of the implications for everything, starting with the individual units and how you guys are thinking about optimizing Cathedra's fleet. And then from there, we'll talk about implications for larger fleet management and firmware options. But Isaac, I'll actually throw it back to you first for this question, and then back up to Reet. Tell me a little bit about what the implications are for the units that you guys are now controlling at Cathedra and further deployments.
Sure. So, you can go one of two ways, right? You can have, more hash rate and less efficiency, or you can, with these underclocking techniques, you can increase your efficiency, but you're producing less hash rate. So an underclock, the trade-off is, okay, I'm going to produce less overall revenue, but the amount I get to take home as a percentage is higher of that revenue, right? Whereas overclocking, you're getting more incremental revenue, but your percentage of that revenue is less, right? So in a bear market, you do not want to overclock, right? Because in a bear market, margins are really tight. And so if you're giving up a larger percentage of your margin, then that you start to, not be profitable anymore. And so, bear markets sort of push the standard clocks on machines into that regime where, hey, it's not profitable anymore. And historically, what happens is you just turn it off, right? Or you sort of, mine in a war of attrition, baring your teeth and staring into the void, right? And just sort of hope conditions improve, right? Those are sort of your options historically. With these techniques, it's like, okay, well, instead of just turning stuff off or hoping for a reprieve, you could just say, all right, well, I'm going to, reduce my overall income, but I still have margin. I can still run a profitable company in a bear market. Now, and that makes intuitive sense, right? So just sort of, thinking about limits in calculus, as Bitcoin goes towards zero, you want to reduce your fixed costs, which is, predominantly your power bill, but as Bitcoin goes to infinity, you can afford to mine at almost any price, right? So, if you have got a 40 cent per kilowatt hour power bill or something like that, but Bitcoin is, a couple of million bucks, like, yeah, plug those miners in, get the S7s rolling again, it doesn't matter. You can afford to mine at any price. So it's just a matter of doing the analysis of, okay, what are margins that I can get on a per machine basis, right? And so it's always been, hey, what can I get for this machine? But efficiency has always been compared between models. It has not historically been compared between clocks available on a individual miner. So I think that will create a much richer environment for optimization for being creative, right? And just to expand off of that slightly, it matters what kind of infrastructure you have. So if you're on an off-grid deployment, you've already paid for a generator, you've already paid for a fixed amount of gas coming in, whatnot, it doesn't necessarily make sense to just have better efficiency, because it's basically a take or pay situation where, look, I've already got a fixed cost for my generation of power. It doesn't make sense to make these run more efficiently, because then I'm leaving potential generation capacity on the table. So in that context, either you would have to, bring out an additional container and more miners to fill up your generation to take advantage of that, or potentially you have a multi-generator site and you could peel off some of those generators, redeploy them, liquidate them or whatever. If you're on grid and you're in a situation where you can afford to just say, hey, I'm going to just lower my power bill by, reducing my power consumption, you're sort of more adaptable in a certain sense. Now, there's other considerations there, like demand charges, limits within, thresholds and the amount of power that you're required to offtake, that sort of thing. But still, there's the potential to be much more flexible on an on-grid situation, because it's more firmware than logistics at that point. But there's lots of considerations. I think it'll have implications for how power, for how PPAs are set up, for how people deploy their infrastructure. It'll be exciting to see how it all plays out.
When you guys are doing the underclocking, how are you guys going about that with a lot of the Antminer models, at the very least being like closed box, hard to like get in there? Are you guys custom making your own firmware to underclock it, or using like Vanish or Brains and just like having
things? We thought about making our own firmware, but great people working on it already. So we've tried everything. We've tried firmware from Chipless, Brains, ASIC.to. We even tried out the beta of Luxor's new firmware. So we've tried a little of everything. At the end of the day, once you can sort of get direct control over voltage and frequency, it doesn't matter as much. You know, the chip's going to do what the chip's going to do. So yeah, you just need to have that fine tuned control over the parameters of the chips. Speaking broadly, the auto tune can be pretty helpful for squeezing the absolute most out of a particular machine, right?
Yeah.
But in that process, you sort of have to provide parameters on where you want it to look. And if you don't necessarily have an intuitive sense of where a good place to look is, you're not going to get the best out of it because you're looking in a range. You're sort of optimizing in the wrong range, right? And so you sort of need both. You need the ability to say, okay, in general, what is a really good clock for this kind of hardware? And then you can go back through and fine tune it. So what we were really focused on originally was, okay, what is a clock that works just statically across the fleet, not fine tuning chips at all at first, right? Just like, what's something that in general is going to work? And then afterwards you can go back through and fine tune those things. But it just depends on what you're solving for. And again, it really depends on your infrastructure. It depends on what you're trying to do with the hardware. Also, if you're participating in something like demand response, you don't necessarily want the absolute best clock, because what if you're turning on and off all the time, right?
Yeah.
You can't necessarily afford to have it sit there and auto tune all day if you're trying to just move very quickly. So sometimes, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, depending on your individual circumstance. But there's different tools for different situations.
The implications are very, very big, right? Because as Isaac said, you can dynamically tune these depending on what you need. Now, you can look at the grid. It depends on where your point of reference is in respect to either, is it the grid? Is it profitability? Is it the hash price? There are a lot of inputs that you can kind of point your North Star to and say, hey, this is what is going to make the most sense. The biggest constraint, so when we design a containerized solution, you say, how much power can I get at each end of the plug? And that is going to then size the amount of electrical that you're going to have to put into that container. And you say, okay, well, that container is now 700 kilowatts, 800 kilowatts. The difference is that when you start underclocking, you need, say that you cut your power consumption in half. That means you need double the amount of spaces, rack spaces, in order to consume the same amount of power. If you have existing infrastructure that you can kind of expand into and you're limited by power or the power capacity, then you have wiggle room. And so it's looking at power capacity, power rates, rack space, and all these different variables and see what you have as an asset, right? If you can take all these and categorize them, it's like, what are your goals? Are your goals max profitability, max utilization? If you have extra machines, great. Then you are now maximizing your operating profit in the best way possible. So, even if you had two separate sites and with two different power rates, it doesn't mean that you should actually shove all the machines that you possibly can into your cheapest site. We've been working algorithmically to say, hey, what's the best blended rate at the best kind of efficiency rate? And as things get better, you can also then use those sites that are kind of, we'll call it, overfilled, to start expanding into new places as the hash price recovers and so on.
Gotcha. No, thank you so much for that. Any final thoughts from you guys as we close up here in a second? Just from an outsider's perspective and from looking at some recent stuff with S19 XPs and talking with firmware providers, it does seem like there's a huge space for this, right? A huge space for growth here. But any final thoughts from either of you guys?
I would say that the just go test, because the whole point of doing that heat map and testing was to see what the possibilities were. It's clear in the charts, for example, we can continue underclocking, but there is a point of, you know, it doesn't make sense to go any further because the efficiency actually gets worse. So as this whole kind of city grid light analogy comes through, is that there are certain physical proclivities that the machine likes to operate at, and they're different for each different machine. So really what we want to do, or what a miner should do, is saying, hey, let's go find these bands of these different machines. Let's see how they all interplay and work together. Because, you know, you may not just have XPs or S19s. You might have a mixed bag and see what makes sense when you start testing each different machine type.
Yeah, I guess, you know, one thing I would say is, you know, playing these sorts of underclocking games, it's going to change the way people look at older machines. So, you know, I think about the S9, where, you know, Brains came out with a great underclock firmware. You know, that's what it was. You know, it reduced the power you're running through the machine and the hash rate a little bit, but you got great efficiency, and they extended that life cycle of the S9. I think that's a trend we can sort of expect with lots of different models, where, you know, once you can get in there with firmware, you could find, you know, the lower bounds of what's truly possible efficiency-wise on a machine, and you could see some of these older models starting to make a comeback. And so that's going to, you know, tick tock, next block, it's going to start increasing difficulty, right? Because more people can afford to, you know, subsist at lower hash prices. So I think that's sort of an interesting trend. I think it also creates an interesting dynamic when you're assessing, you know, machine acquisition. Like, hey, you know what, how can I do more with less? And so, you know, what if we can buy a bunch of these older models that have sort of been overlooked and tossed away, and we can implement some of these, you know, firmware tricks and get them live again, you know. But then you have to also do the analysis of, well, if I'm using a lot less power per, you know, spot on the rack, then I need a lot more racks to plug all of those in. And then eventually I'm going to have to, you know, retire those. Then what can I put there? Can I, the newer models be underclocked as much? It starts to get pretty interesting and dynamic when you look at all the different ways that you can, you know, generate a profitable, you know, Bitcoin, right? You know, there's lots of ways to do it. So I think the different strategies, the different approaches different miners take, it's going to be vast, and it's going to be really interesting to see what miners do to be creative in the space moving forward.
Love that. Yeah, difficulty is bearing down on us. We're looking at like a 12% increase pretty soon here. Hopefully it's not that high, but we'll see what it comes in as. But Reet, Isaac, thank you again so much for joining the Mining Pod. For those listening, where can they find either of you guys, either on Twitter or other places?
You go.
Sure, yeah, on Twitter. I think Isaac, at Isaac Fithian, and at Reet B, I think it is.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, we can, I don't know if you have like an info place we can drop our handles if you want, but yeah, come hit us up.
We'll drop your guys' handles on the bottom. Yeah, if anyone's listening to the show and you think it's interesting, or you want to integrate this into your own mining site, be sure to hit them up on Twitter. You can also look at Cathedra Bitcoin, which is a publicly listed miner in Canada. And shout out to AJ and Drew. Also, they join the podcast every once in a while. But we'll see you guys later. Thanks again, Isaac. Thanks, Reet.
Thanks for the time.